today for a discussion on the management of cardiovascular risk in the setting of statin intolerance is Dr. Dan Soffer. Dan is a clinical associate professor of medicine in the Department of General Internal Medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine of the University of Pennsylvania. His clinical focus is clinical lipidology, preventive cardiovascular medicine, and general internal medicine. Dan is a true thought leader in lipid management, and I'm really excited to spend a few minutes with him today to hear his insights on how we can do a better job managing lipids and cardiovascular risk, particularly in the setting of our patients with statin intolerance. Welcome, Dan.
Hello, Greg. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Dan, I'm really glad you could join me today. So, as you well know, lipid management is really at the core of managing the risk of cardiovascular disease. Statin therapy has been the leading strategy for lowering lipids for many years and really is a very effective treatment. You know, anybody that's managing lipids knows it and uses it regularly, but unfortunately, there is this definite percentage of patients that just can't seem to tolerate them. And managing those patients, as well as their cardiovascular risk, becomes increasingly more difficult for us to do. So, Dan, I was hoping to start off our discussion today by really hearing from you on the risks of adverse effects with statins. Most of us are familiar with myalgias, but there's increasing concern about diabetes and some other potential risks that I think is worth spending a couple of minutes. What can you share with us about that?
Well, it's good to think about all of the potential risks from any therapy, Greg. And probably the most important risk before we get into the side effects is the risk of not taking the medication that is so important for the prevention of serious cardiovascular events. And so I always factor that into the discussion when I'm talking to my patients about risks from the medicine. So there's the risks of taking the medicine. There's also the risks of not taking the medicine. And we can talk about that too. But the risks of the medicines directly, the side effects, are really very few, although there's probably a laundry list in the package insert that bears paying attention to some degree. The myopathy, the myalgias, the myositis, the rhabdomyolysis, all of the entire spectrum of muscle complications is something that takes front and center and what people pay attention to more than anything else. But increasingly, people are asking about things like, is there a risk for dementia from this? I read about this. Is there a brain fog? So neurocognitive effects is something that has made its way into the popular press. The hyperglycemia effect of taking statin therapy is something that was probably most notably recognized in a study called the Jupiter study that showed that there was an increase in blood glucose. And this has been seen in some other major statin studies as well. The risk from hemorrhagic stroke is something that people pay attention to a little bit when looking at the fine print and seeing what can happen with significant LDL cholesterol reduction and seeing that there's a small signal for increase in an uncommon or almost rare event of hemorrhagic stroke. And it's hard to know exactly how common or how much attention should be paid to something that is so rare and so uncommon, but it is something that people do ask about. Those are probably the most common associated effects from the statins. And they're worth paying attention to, and they do come up in conversation when counseling patients about statin therapy.
So how do you weigh that or have that discussion if a patient says, well, you're giving me a statin, but it's going to raise my risk of diabetes. Why should I do that? Because that carries a risk of having heart disease by itself. How do you counsel them on that?
Yeah, it is really an issue of weighing the risks versus the benefits in a quantitative way. It's a great question when patients ask it because it's a real phenomena and it is an expected phenomena, though it's a small effect in most people. There is a rare occasion where an individual have a bigger blood sugar impact from taking a statin therapy, but that is very uncommon. Most of the people who have an impact from their glucose are the patients who are predisposed to hyperglycemia to begin with, and they will have other features that suggest that they either have prediabetes or diabetes. And so those are the people I'm going to be more likely to counsel in advance of having this problem. And I'll point out to them that even if they get a small but real increase in their blood sugar and they convert from high normal into the pre-diabetic range or from the pre-diabetic range into the diabetic range, it's going to be a small effect, and that it's a quantitative variance between them. And it's a small effect, and that all of our diabetic patients, I let them know, we are offering statin therapy to begin with. And so it's not something that we is considered a contraindication. It's just something that needs to be managed. So it's a side effect that needs to be managed. It's a stronger indication to pay more attention to lifestyle modification to try to mitigate some of the blood sugar increases. And possibly it's an indication to put somebody on blood sugar lowering therapy to mitigate that increase. But it's a small effect, doesn't usually require a major change in the therapy.
I would agree with that. And my response to my patients when I've been presented with those discussions is they're more likely to have an adverse event from cardiovascular disease than a complication related to diabetes from these medications. So I would always encourage treating the more serious condition and address the potential rise in blood sugar. So it sounds like you're on board with that.
That's exactly right, Greg. I really try to drive home the point that they have a condition that puts them at significant risk. I'll quantify it for them and remind them that the foundation of pharmacotherapy for cardiovascular risk reduction is always going to be a statin, and that everything else you do with regards to medicine to reduce cardiovascular risk is something that you would ultimately and hopefully add to a statin to enhance the benefits of statins, not to replace it.
So as you started off your discussion earlier, you alluded to the more significant problem of the risk of not taking medications to cardiovascular disease. And I've seen some recent studies that have come out looking at the higher rates of cardiovascular disease in patients that have statin intolerance versus those that have high adherence. Can you discuss some of those with our colleagues that may not be familiar with them?
Right. So, of course, the model for this is the prospective studies, the randomized placebo-controlled trials that show that people at cardiovascular risk when taking statins have lower event rates than people who are given placebo. But subsequent studies of large populations and population databases have demonstrated that there's increased rates of myocardial infarction and increased rates of other cardiovascular events in patients who are non-adherent to prescribed statin therapy. And non-adherence can come from a lot of different causes. It can be due to side effects. It can be due to cost. It can be due to contraindications with certain medications, but non-adherence to the optimal therapy with statins has an increased burden of cardiovascular events, and that's been demonstrated in clinical trial.
So Dan, NACE has done a lot of education in lipids over the years, and one of the most common questions that seem to come up time and again, and in our discussion is very relevant, is that with CK monitoring, you know, where are you using that in your practice before, during, after, and how is that impacting what you're doing?
That's a great question, Greg. I think I get asked that question almost every single time I give a talk on any lipid subject. It always comes down to that, because I think traditionally CK has been used as the tool to know whether or not somebody has muscle problems. And it's a very imperfect tool in that respect. And clinical decision-making can definitely go on without measuring CK levels for most patients who are complaining of statin-associated muscle problems. So when we do use CK testing, I do like to get a CK level before initiating statin therapy when it's convenient. I have to say I do not send patients off to the lab just to get a CK level in before I start their statin therapy if they haven't had one done before. I don't think it's practical. I don't think it adds that much more to the management of the care. And I don't think it's worth going to get a separate blood test just for that purpose. But if I have an indication to do other blood testing before I'm starting their statin therapy, then sure, I will do a CK prior to therapy in case there's any problems down the road and I need a point of comparison, especially in patients who already have muscle problems, various body aches. And in those patients, I might be a little more, I might find it a little more urgent to go get their CK level tested before they start that statin therapy in case I have a high expectation of muscle side effects. In patients who call the office to complain that they don't feel good on their statins, but they're not, it's not severe enough that they even need to come into the office. They just, in fact, oftentimes will talk to my staff about their complaints where it sounds like it's a more mild symptom. They definitely do not need to have a CK level tested. The next step in therapy should be a statin holiday. And in most cases, 2 weeks is adequate, as much as 4 weeks may be needed. And in the odd patient, maybe as much as 3 months if they've been on statins for a very long time and they have persistent residual aches and pains before you're convinced that you've had their statin stop for long enough to test the hypothesis. If the patient calls and it seems to be more than just mild myalgias, that's where CK testing, I think, has more of a role. And oftentimes, those are patients you need to bring into the office to really evaluate and to really assess the amount of pain they have. And that's where a CK test should be considered. And then finally, of course, the patient who has severe enough symptoms based upon their complaint that they need to go to the emergency department, that they, you know, the classic, they feel like a truck ran them over, that kind of severe pain, especially with weakness, a CK level is mandatory. Another odd case where you might get a call is if there's a change in the color of the urine, you know, a darkening of the urine. In those patients, I definitely want to get a CK level, even if they're not complaining of severe pain. But pretty much saving the CK testing for the patients, for the symptomatic patients with severe symptoms, as opposed to more mild symptoms, unless there's some clear weakness associated with it.
I think people are well accustomed to utilizing statins, first line therapy. What I think would be helpful is what you're using in your practice to help patients tolerate these medicines when they are presenting to you. We understand that it's real important. What are some potential alternate dosing regimens that might be helpful? Talk about switching drugs or classes or OTC supplements such as coenzyme Q10 or vitamin D. What other strategies are you using that might help us get these patients to take these critical drugs?
It's a great question. Again, I can tell you that's a question that I think many primary care doctors have gotten very good at answering on their own. I see a lot of patients who get referred already and who, where in years past, they might not have tried any of these things, but have already gone through a lot of different things before they come to see me. But I have to say, I don't think there's any really great antidote to statin-associated myalgias in terms of taking something else to offset the aches and pains. The ones you mentioned, coenzyme Q10 or vitamin D supplementation, probably are the two that are best studied. And when you look at randomized placebo-controlled trials with coenzyme Q10, and now there have been about four studies that have been pretty well designed. They're relatively small, but these are in patients with statin-associated myalgias, that the benefits of coenzyme Q10 seem to be roughly equivalent to placebo. And recently, there was actually a meta-analysis that looked at that and concluded that coenzyme Q10 supplementation does not offset statin-associated myalgias for the most part. But there probably are individuals who will respond. And so it's not impossible to, it doesn't exclude that as a therapy to consider as to work as an antidote for this problem. Vitamin D has some information, some clinical trial evidence to suggest the same type of benefit, mostly in patients with very severe vitamin D deficiency, not just mild insufficiency. And in some of those cases, their aches and pains happen whether or not they're on statins. And so repleting somebody's vitamin D who's already complaining about body aches is probably a good idea before you initiate some other therapy that might cause body aches like statins. And so that is something that we do routinely test if somebody complains about body aches. But the evidence is not very strong. And I don't want you to think that that's something that is written in any kind of guideline or a strong recommendation that vitamin D or CoQ10 have benefit. As a matter of fact, the national guidelines suggest that CoQ10 has no role in this, and I'm really giving you my own personal experience and a brief review of the literature that's available for both of those things. In my experience, the most important intervention for statin-associated myalgias is dose or brand adjustment. So there are seven different statins, plus red yeast rice, which acts as a HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor also. And some people may respond to one differently than they respond to another. When you look at the clinical trial evidence and the rates of occurrence of statin-associated myalgias, the occurrence rate seems to go up at the higher end of the dose range for any of the statins. So, for example, with pravastatin, you're more likely to have myalgias at 40 milligrams than you would with 10 milligrams. Same thing with rosuvastatin, same thing with simvastatin, same thing with atorvastatin. So at the higher end of the dose range, more likely to have myalgias. So if you're trying to achieve the optimal LDL cholesterol lowering, the benefit of using a high-potency statin is that you can get away with low doses of a high-potency statin. For example, atorvastatin or rosuvastatin at their lower dose range, 5 or 10 milligrams or 20 milligrams. That is probably the most effective way to get optimal LDL cholesterol lowering with the dose that does something more potent. Whereas if you use a low-potency statin like lovastatin or pravastatin at a low dose, you're not going to get very much LDL cholesterol lowering. And so you're helping the patient less. The other benefit of atorvastatin and rosuvastatin is that they have longer half-lives. So all of the other statins have half-lives, pharmacologic half-lives, that are less than 4 hours and have to be taken at bedtime and really have to be taken on a daily basis. Whereas atorvastatin and rosuvastatin have a long pharmacologic half-life and can be taken on an every other day basis, a three time a week basis, even twice a week. And in some rare circumstances, we'll even do weekly therapy with one of those two statins, atorva or rosuvastatin. I find that to be the most effective strategy after an appropriate statin holiday in somebody who has myalgias.
I want to let our listeners know that you can access an enduring CME activity on the management of cardiovascular risk in statin intolerant patients at our website, naceonline.com. And you can learn more about what Dan and I are discussing today. You can access this and many other programs we have developed on other topics as well. You can also register for one or more of the live conferences we produce every year. If you're on Facebook, please like us and we'll be able to share more educational content and information with you. So Dan, I'd like to move on and talk about some of the newer lipid-lowering medications that are just on the market, which may offer our colleagues more therapeutic choices, and they may not be so familiar with them because of their relative recent introduction. So bempedoic acid is the newest on the block. It was recently approved alone and in combination with ezetimibe. I'd love to hear your thoughts about it, how it works, and where it may be positioned in the care of our patients.
Greg, bempedoic acid is interesting because it's a pure LDL cholesterol lowering therapy that was newly FDA approved. And it's very good to have additional LDL cholesterol lowering therapies for the reasons that we've been talking about, that statin associated myalgias, for one, are going to limit the use of high potency, high intensity statins. And in some of our patients, in order to get the optimal LDL cholesterol lowering, you're going to need other strategies like taking some non-statin to lower the LDL cholesterol. So bempedoic acid is a small molecule inhibitor of ATP citrate lyase, which is an enzyme that probably none of the listeners have heard of before, but it's in the cholesterol synthetic pathway, higher up in the pathway than HMG-CoA reductase. And so other strategies to inhibit cholesterol synthesis in other aspects of the pathway have not been as successful, but inhibiting this enzyme in particular has demonstrated in clinical trials and in preclinical studies to be effective for cholesterol synthesis inhibition. Now, it stands apart from statin therapy in that the pill itself, bempedoic acid, is a prodrug, and the prodrug itself is not active on the cholesterol synthetic pathway. And in order to be activated, there's an enzyme in the hepatocytes that activates it specifically that's not found in any significant quantity in other tissues, especially in muscle tissues. So bempedoic acid does not have cholesterol synthetic inhibition in the muscle and in elsewhere. And so you're specifically lowering your cholesterol synthesis, reducing cholesterol synthesis in the hepatocyte, which for the listeners who may not know this, this biochemistry quite as well, the hepatocyte cholesterol concentration is kept at relatively constant levels at all times. And there are multiple redundant mechanisms for maintaining that cholesterol level the same. And so as you inhibit cholesterol within the hepatocyte, the liver cell responds by upregulating the LDL receptor. And that's ultimately the final common pathway of how statins reduce serum levels of LDL cholesterol. There's more upregulation of the LDL receptor. Bempedoic acid achieves the same thing. You get upregulation of the LDL receptor, removal of LDL particles from the circulation, but you do not get as much LDL cholesterol lowering as you do from statin drugs. And I don't think the physiology is exactly clear as to why that is, but on average, you get about a 17% LDL cholesterol reduction. And in combination with other therapies, that additional LDL cholesterol reduction can be very significant clinically.
So Dan, since this agent is brand new and there's no guidelines yet for its use, there are no cardiovascular outcome trials, where do you see it being positioned in the care of our patients? Where might be the right place to use it?
Yeah, right now it's tricky. I think that statins, of course, are the foundation. Ezetimibe, based upon guideline recommendations, is second when you're trying to lower LDL cholesterol further. PCSK9 inhibitors in patients who meet qualification, meaning they have clinical ASCVD or familial hypercholesterolemia, makes sense. And then in those individual patients who still have LDL cholesterol level above their threshold for more pharmacotherapy, it's very reasonable to consider adding another agent. And at that point, you have a choice between bempedoic acid or colesevelam or some of the other bile acid sequestrants. And as you know, Greg, bile acid sequestrants are just very hard to take. And when you weigh the pros and cons of adding something else like that, I think bempedoic acid has a role in that setting.
Anything else coming on the horizon that our colleagues need to be aware of?
Yeah, there's actually some novel therapy that's around the corner. The closest one to fruition is a medication called inclisiran. It's a small inhibitor, RNA inhibitor, which is a pharmacotherapeutic approach that I think most of our listeners have almost no familiarity with. We're starting to get used to monoclonal antibodies. They're finding their way into regular therapy, but RNA inhibition or RNA silencing therapy is something that is starting to appear in different parts of medicine. And so this is a specialized medicine that is an RNA silencing agent that works primarily in the hepatocyte. It blocks the synthesis of the PCSK9 protein by blocking the RNA, and you get lower levels of PCSK9 and better LDL receptor recycling. And so I guess you can sense the common theme here. Statin drugs cause LDL receptor, increased LDL receptor density and better LDL clearance. Ezetimibe causes increased LDL receptor density and better LDL clearance. Bempedoic acid does the same thing. PCSK9 monoclonal antibodies does the same thing. And a PCSK9 silencing drug also does the same thing. Increased LDL receptor density, better LDL clearance. So clearing the LDL particles is where the benefit from these medicine comes from.
Dan, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today and share your expertise on how we can do a better job of lipid management, especially in our patients that are intolerant of statins, and the role of some of the newer agents that you've just detailed for us. I think this information is really useful and hopefully will help our colleagues do a better job of caring for the patients that they see in their practice and really make a difference in their lives. So thank you so much for joining me today to share your thoughts on this, at times, very challenging issue.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate the opportunity. It's good to see you.
So everybody, if you're interested in learning more about lipid management, go to the NACE website at naceonline.com and register for our enduring activities on hyperlipidemia or any other program we have developed. Please like us on Facebook at NACME to be part of our online social media community and get access to other content and programs we share. I want to thank you, our audience, for joining us for this podcast. I hope you've learned something new you can bring back to your practice. We look forward to having you join us for other upcoming podcasts in the near future. Be well.